Welcome, so good morning, everybody. It is so wonderful to be back. Let us learn Torah. So we have an unbelievable opportunity now as we march forward in our going through the crash course in Jewish history. I want to thank Sri Stern for sponsoring this series. But Gadol, there's no specific sponsor for today. But let's learn. We'll get to that. This will be afterwards. Mitzvah Shem. Let us jump straight into our learning. So we're now at a stage called the end of life. So we've gone through a lot of wonderful milestones in life. Now we get to more complicated times in life. And that is toward is the end. But the truth is, it's not really about the end of life. It's about planning for the end of life, which most people don't like to do because it involves thinking about these things. But let me guarantee you, thinking about these things makes it a lot easier than not thinking about these things. Just an absolute guarantee. If one doesn't plan, one is going to have problems. And it's just the way it is. So a few difficult conversations actually end up being very important. So what should one be doing when planning for the end of life? And it's an amazing thing. So like, you know, I speak to colleagues and contemporaries of mine who are not in the rabbinates, right? So people who are, you know, young families and so on, they don't go to shiva houses. If they go to a funeral, it's like out of the blue because they're not on the stage where their contemporaries are dying at, right? So it may be a grandparent and so on. So they're just not exposed to this. And slowly as life goes on, unfortunately, we are exposed more and more to people we love and care for who pass away. And then we start thinking, and then we start saying, wait a second, we should be thinking about this. And then at a certain point, we say, well, really, we should ask a few questions. And that's sort of what happens, and we start planning. But it's important to make time to start the planning, to think about these things big at all. So let's go through some basics. So when trying to put one's affairs in order, what should we be doing? So I just put a quick checklist of things. Number one is halachic healthcare proxy. We'll get to that in a second. Number two is legal will should be sorted out. You know what they say, when there's a will, there's a relative. So you have to make sure that that you have to make sure to figure things out now so there's not going to be machlokas later on. Number three is setting up the halachic will. We'll get to that in a second. Also, one should ensure that there is karka which is bought. I remember somebody in the shul told me that they took their parents around to the different cemeteries and so on, and they said, so what did you decide? Then they said, we decided we're not dying. The problem was that plan didn't work. And so when they ended up dying, they didn't have land. And when they don't have land, well, guess what? The rate of land within 24 hours is much more expensive than if you have to figure it out, if you figure it out ahead of time. So it's not very nice to have to buy karka. But it's a schusim, it's a shem, we should have many, many long years, but don't wait, because it'll be premium value later on as well. And similarly, one should make sure that one's relatives have the arrangements, and there should be money set aside. Funerals can be expensive. You can map out, you can see what they cost now, and one can set this up ahead of time. Make sure that there's the money's earmarked, the funeral home is earmarked, and people know, the family knows, it's not going to be a scramble, it's not going to be a difficult thing. If and when it's necessary, and it should be a schus that one doesn't have to deal with this for many, many, many good and healthy years as well. Similarly, one should make sure one's social affairs are in order. Social affairs means to say those machloiksem which still remain unresolved, the money which remains owed, all the things that one has not and one says one will and one should and one didn't ask, and those are very important things to take care of. As well. So this is just a general checklist. The Gesher HaChayim has a checklist as well in the Rav Yechiel Michal Kuchinsky's discussion in his Sefer. Gesher HaChayim means the bridge of life, talks about this and that. It's also important to set up doing staka with one's assets. Remember, when one goes to the next world, one is not able to get staka. Just that's it. This is the Olam HaAsiyah, this is the world of doing. That Hayom L'Asosam L'Mocha L'Kabel Schoram. Today is the day we can do. Tomorrow we receive reward, and so we need to make sure to do. In fact, I was going through. Actually, I was looking at the Encyclopedia Talmudit, and I was just going through the Yizkor section, and in it, there happens to be an opinion in the Rishonim that the things that one's children does for one's after one's life does not accrue value or merit for oneself. There is such an opinion. Now, we generally don't follow that. We follow that, yes, when children do things or when people do things based on our influence, we continue to grow. But that first opinion actually says it's only when I actually said it should happen, when I put it into motion. So now we don't pask in that way, which means, but it is worthwhile to think about is, why not do that? Why not say, I want it to be that my foundation, my will, my trust, my this is going to be giving X amount of stock after I pass away? Why not do that? Why not set it up already now without leaving it up to the imagination of other people? Like these, and then it's just it's a beautiful thing, but people don't like to think about this, talk about this. One likes to make sure the assets are divided, but give it stock and now and beyond. These things can be set up. Now, let's go through each of these one by one. Most complicated of all of these right now is the halachic healthcare proxy, okay? So what is the halachic healthcare proxy? It's a very simple document. So I actually have three of them here, and I'm happy to, I printed out a bunch of them. You're welcome to take a look at them afterwards. This is the, I got this Israel one. So this is the halachic health, it's called Living Will. This is the RCA one. And this is the one I actually just found, somebody gave this to me, is the Chaim Arukim one. They're all the same thing, essentially. What it really is it's appointing somebody who's going to be the person to make decisions if one's not in a capacity to be able to make decisions, and in concert with a rabbi of one's choosing. And then there's, of course, there's a alternative proxy and alternative rabbi, because sometimes one may outlive the proxy or outlive the rabbi. And so one wants to make sure in that situation that there's somebody who is able to do this. And this is state or country dependent, which means that because the laws in different states and in different countries differ, then therefore the legal framework necessary also differs. So one needs to be signing something that relates to one's locale, and the decisions needing to be made in those locales. So if one looks at these healthcare proxies, a lot of them are New York State, because that's where a lot of these were created, because that relates to the law in New York State as to listening to be able to a patient's decision as well. These are very easy to find. You can find multiple versions of these online. Just make sure that it comes from a reputable organization. I would recommend the RCA one. Just simple. It's been the RCA has done this for many, 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 many years, and is worthwhile doing this. It is also worthwhile noting that there are little emergency cards as well. So, okay, for instance, the RCA will have at the back of it a little card which is a basic summary of who to contact if, God forbid, one needs to contact. So that, let's say a person, God forbid, an episode happens and a person's found on the sidewalk, and a first responder comes and doesn't know the decisions necessary to be made, and there's no one to ask. It's important that let's say they go through to find ID and they find this little note in the wallet, which is healthcare proxy emergency instructions. He has the agent, he has the alternative agent, he has the rabbi, and he has the alternative rabbi, and their numbers. It's much easier to have that happen than for decisions to be made not on one's behalf as well. Very helpful. The National Association of Chevra Kadisha under our zone has what he calls an Emet card, which is basically the same kind of thing, a little card with the instructions of contact and so on, because there are a lot of decisions that need to be made on the fly, which are important for emergency workers to know. So resuscitation, DNR, DNI, organ donation, and these are the kind of things that if there's no space to discuss, somebody needs to be able to be in contact. So just some these are Eitzah Tova Kamash Ronan as well to do this. Now, why is this different from, yeah?
What's the difference between healthcare proxy, the halachic healthcare proxy, and the one that you sign in the hospital?
I was about to just, that was the next question. So any responsible person needs to have a living will, right? And a living will is this, right, which is the healthcare proxy. And anybody, your estate planner, your doctor will tell you you need to have a living will, right?
They're
you,
not the same thing.
What was that?
They're not the same.
They're not the same thing.
The same.
There is an advance directive which comes with the one that one would sign in the hospital. So, for instance, the living will of New York State. If you go to the New York State government website, there'll be a living will which will include an advance directive. The advance directive is where it becomes a little more murky, is because the advance directive will try to plan out as many of the decisions that need to be made then, now. And so the problem with some of that is that not all of those decisions can be made right now. There are certain ones which can, but certain ones which can't, because it's situation dependent. And so although it would be an average person who, let's say, has a conversation with their doctor or their estate planner or somebody who's helping them, will say you should sign the living will, a lot of times people will go to the New York State living, with the advance directive and the whole business. And it's not so simple. It's not so simple that a Jew should be going in that direction, because of what we're going to discuss in just a moment as well. In Judaism, the basic starting point is that Judaism values what is called the sanctity of life, which means to say that it is a schus, it's a merit to be alive for any amount of time. And that schus we can't measure, we don't know, we can't quantify it, but we know that it's a merit for a person to be alive, and therefore we will do within our control, try to ensure that a person remains alive as well. You know, this Rav Chaim Shmulevitz talks about this in Sichos Musar, where he says, listen to this perspective. You know that there's famously, there were three advisors to Paro, right? So, and these advisors were asked about the final solution to do with the Hebrews, right? So Pharaoh said, there's this nation, they're growing bigger, they're going to be a fifth column, the whole business. What should we do? So famously, they were, what are the names of those advisors? There was Yisro, Eov, and Bilam, right? So what did Bilam say? Bilam says, well, there's this fellow in the future, in 1941, who's going to suggest something. I would suggest the same thing, right? Get rid of them. Babies in the river, the whole thing, right? So that was Bilam's approach to things. Then Yisro says, are you crazy? What are you doing? These are human beings. What are you talking about, right? And then there was the middle of the road, which is Yisro. What did Yisro do?
Nothing.
Nothing. He was silent. It was Eov was silent. Yisro objected. Bilam collaborated, and Eov was silent. So the Midrash says that each of them had the, so to speak, the outcomes of the actions. Bilam ultimately was killed for his advice. Yisro became, so to speak, the part of the family. Right? He was had the schus of being attached to Moshe Rabbeinu, and Eov suffered. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, like, but he's, why should his silence? Isn't like Bilam didn't give Bilam get the better option? I mean, like Bilam, like, okay, so he was killed by the sword, but that, I mean, Eov had prolonged suffering. That's terrible. Why would that be? Why would he get worse than Bilam? So Rav Chaim Shlomit says is because when a person's alive, albeit when a person's suffering, that's a much greater schus than being dead. Now, just to put that in perspective, that's the framework. Now, in halacha, it happens to be there are different opinions as to how far one can go with that. So there are opinions in halacha, for example, that Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Waldenberg, who believe that the sanctity of life is at all costs, which means to say one should do everything extreme measures to be able to ensure that. And so therefore you'll see some people and some families who are being advised in such a situation where they'll do everything necessary. So in the old days, there was less one could do. Now with medical technology, there's more one can do. One will do more, even if at the cost of that comes discomfort, pain, and sometimes we don't even know when a person's in a comatose state as well. However, the majority of the poskim are not in that camp. The majority of the poskim say that the sanctity of life is an absolute value, but there's certain times where the sanctity of life is also waived. So for instance, we're allowed to go to war, right? There's the Gimel Chamuros, the three cardinal sins. Not every time do we say sanctity of life trumps everything. And so there are certain situations where the sanctity of life can, in fact, be waived. It can be waived under certain circumstances, dependent on a few situations. So what are those circumstances? The way that, again, there are different... There are different ways of putting the needle in this spectrum, and one has to be very careful as to which posik one's consulting and how one knows about this. But I'm going to go for at this point in time and the guidance that I received, which is from Rabbi Dr. Steinberg, who's just in our shul actually recently, and Rav Willig. So Rav Steinberg, in his encyclopedia called Harufua Ka'alacha, in the 10th volume, where he talks about what's called Sofeh Chayim, the end of life, or Sofeh Chayim, he points out that there are three criteria that a person needs to have in order for all extensive intervention to be waived. Number one is the patient is in the geder of what's called chayei shah, the end of life. Number two is the patient does not want to continue to live under such circumstances. And number three is that because the medical condition and the pain are such, most people in such a situation would not want their life to continue under such circumstances. Let's reverse for a second. What is Chayei Shah? How do you define a person who's in the state of Chayei Shah, end of life? So for this, the way it's defined based on the poskim, and there is a slight difference over here in terms of time, but a person who has a terminal irreversible illness whose progression cannot be stopped, and their expectation of life is not longer than a few months. Now, a few months happens to be a little bit of a debate. There are those who are mekil to say 6 months, and there are those who are machmir to say 3 months. Rabbi Yoshua would say 3 months. So if a person is saying has a prognosis of an irreversible disease, a terminal disease which cannot be stopped, and a person has 3 months of life, they're in the getter of Chai Shah, coupled with the fact that the patient does not want to undergo extensive and painful treatment, and coupled with the fact that other people in that situation would not want to go through this, that would be a grounds to relieve certain treatments or aggressive interventions or medications in those circumstances. Very, very much situation dependent. I'll add in one extra thing. Whenever I speak to Rav Mordechai Willig about these kind of situations, he always asks one extra question, which Rav Steinberg does not, and that is the patient able to think at this point in time? Is the patient able to go to? Is the patient lucid? Now, it could be the patient cannot communicate, but they could be lucid. And if that's the case, that's an extra consideration, because lucidity is of value, because a person is able to fulfill mitzvahs if a person has the wherewithal to do so. And that means to say that a person can do teshuva for their entire life when in a mental state of awareness. They can do Avas Hashem, Yiras Hashem, the sixth constant mitzvahs, and Shuva being the most important right now for our situations, because Yofa Shah Achas Ba'olam Hazeh, Shal Shuva Ma'asim Tovim, that it's better to be in this world and be able to do those things than to be in a different space. So the patient's lucidity is a critical issue as well when it comes to this, is because a person could be doing things. A lot of times a person will not be in a state of lucidity. They'll be in a comatose state, and it's very hard to know how much they are aware. But there's sometimes a person simply cannot speak, but they are able to think, and that makes a difference as well. So let's say a person is in such a situation. So what can be waived? So certain types of medications can be waived. Let's say it relates to the disease, the progression of the disease. There are certain medications which can specifically be waived. But there are certain things which cannot be waived. For instance, nutrition and liquids cannot be waived unless the doctor's saying that by keeping on with hydration is going to, now the person is not able to metabolize this, and their lungs are going to build up with liquid, and it's going to be a danger to them. But other than that, one can't take away food and medication, food and hydration. That's that is a real concern, unless there's going to be a danger in continuing that as well. Doing that would be essentially murder, right? Because you're essentially starving the person to death, unless there's another reason why there's a danger to be in such a situation. There's lots of complications with treatments that are on cycle, right? So let's say dialysis, right? There's cycles of dialysis. So one may not be required to start a new cycle under such situations. Breathing machines, more complicated because they aren't on cycle. Is there a way to cycleize them? Is there a way to see that they are in a cycle, that you don't have to start a new round? These are the complex kind of questions that one would get to. The most critical question that everybody asks, and this is why the hospital always wants this in an advanced directive, is DNI, right? Which is do not resuscitate, do not intubate. And the way it's usually phrased is this is an elderly patient. There's going to be another episode that's going to happen. And if you don't sign a DNR, then what's going to happen is that we're going to have to legally go to every extent possible to resuscitate this person. And it's not going to give them much time. We're going to have to do compressions, which could break their rib cage, could perforate in bodily organs. It's going to put them in a state of pain, and it's not worth it. It's not worth having that necessarily. That's usually the discussion which is had. I had this discussion last Thursday about somebody. This is the discussion. The hospital does not want to be in a situation where we're talking about somebody who's very elderly, very, very sick, and we're going to just create more pain by resuscitation. And so therefore, they would advise having a DNR signed. So just to clarify, just for a second, yeah, Yossi, yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to procedures?
Good question, such a good, really good question. So let me go back to for a second, then I'll come back to DNR. So the question that Yossi was mentioning beforehand is to what degree, so you can't take away nutrition, but what degree should you ensure that there could be nutrition? So the biggest question is a PEG, right? So if you ask, so I was talking to my sister-in-law, works at New York Presbyterian, and thank you so much, definitely necessary. The protocol in New York Presbyterian, you can tell me if North Wales is the same, is that before a patient or their family can request a PEG is essentially what we used to call in Kam Simcha the Gimel tube, and which essentially allows food. Let's say there's a concern of aspirating, a person's not able to swallow, right? So can you? So one of the ways to do this is that you could put in a PEG where a person can get nutrition directly to the intestinal tract without having to go down the throat. And there is a degree of risk with such an operation. There's a degree of concerns of infection as well. So can we request this? So standing procedure in New York Presbyterian is that you cannot request that without consulting palliative care. Palliative care will always say don't, right? And that's the general, is the hospital's not interested in this because a person could then continue for quite a few months under such a circumstance. I know that a number of post-skim are of the opinion is that when the scars are clear, when there's no problems yet, it is better to put in a tube and to be able to do this with others who are less pushing towards this. One has to evaluate a few things. One is the risk of the procedure, which is there's always a risk. And if a person is really in a frail state and the risk of infection is high, then it's not worth that as well. And it also depends on their general consensus and, according to Ross Steinberg, what the patient themselves would have said, which is why this conversation is important as well. So there's a lot of little pieces over here, and not every situation remains the same as well. Let me come to finish the DNR for a second, then I come back to, I know, sorry, you're very involved in this a lot. So when it comes back to the DNR, just the general recommendation is not to sign a DNR when the skies are clear, meaning to say that for your average person, certainly any young people should definitely not sign a DNR. Right, no person who's young should ever sign a DNR because, God forbid, let's say they're involved in a motor accident, they're taken to the hospital, there's a DNR, that could have given them 50 more years of life, right? And they're not going to resuscitate them because they had a DNR. It's not worth it. Even if a person who's elderly, it's not worth signing a DNR because you don't know. Maybe this was an episode. Maybe this was something that could easily, there could be an easy resuscitation. And then they have a few years. This could have been this discussion should be had is when a person's already hospitalized and they've had an episode and now they're deteriorating, it's terminal, and there's no, at this point in time, there is no chance of recovery. There is no chance of recovery. It's only a matter of time. And now, if God forbid there would be a code, this person, that would be a very severe intervention. In that case, it's only going to give them a few hours. In that case, there is grounds to sign a DNR, but that has to be in the circumstance. It's not a blanket yes or no, which is why it makes it more difficult to sign that advance directive, because they want to know yes or no. And frankly, a lot of times, the hospital doesn't want to have that, would like to have that DNR because in a lot of circumstances, it makes it more complicated. They're going to have a patient who is intubated for a long time, and they don't want to be in such a situation because the person will be suffering in certain circumstances, and it becomes very complicated. Another piece of this as well, Rav Willigoy says this, and one can argue or not argue on this as well, is that sometimes a person walking into hospital with a DNR, also in a certain sense, subconsciously, there's a DNT, which is do not treat, which means to say is, we get the sense that the family isn't so concerned that this person remained alive for so long, so not as much care might be directed in this. Now, whether this is true or not, or different people, different care might be affected by this, hard to measure exactly. But the point is that is a DNR acceptable? The answer is yes. But in every circumstance, no. And that's, I think that's real life. Real life is complex. It's gray. It's not every case demands, every case doesn't. Can the pacemaker be switched off? Same kind of question, right? So if a person is deteriorating and there's the organ failure setting in, then switch off the pacemaker because all it's going to do is shock and create more pain for that person. But when the skies are clear, that's the point of the pacemaker, right? So these are complicated questions which depend on circumstance, which is why one cannot sign away one's entire life in an advanced directive. One needs to say, I would like a competent person to represent me with a competent rabbi who knows my wishes. So you say to yourself, well, how do they know my wishes, right? Because there's so many situation-dependent circumstances. So the answer is, I think this is really, really a worthwhile thing, and I don't think most people do it. And I find this of great value One of the healthcare halachic healthcares is constructed by Ematai, which was Nitivot beforehand. Similar kind of thing. A lot of discussions beforehand. But I would just suggest the following: is at the end of it is a very important section, and it's called a conversation guide. I didn't print this out, but I'm happy to print out more beforehand. So on page 10 to 15 is what's called a conversation guide. And essentially the conversation guide is something which I would recommend everybody has with their healthcare proxy, with their rabbi, and with their primary care physician. And it should be a conversation together. And it essentially goes through various important questions. And there's spectrum questions, and there's yes and no's, there's alternate questions. I agree, I strongly agree, I disagree, I strongly disagree, I have mixed feelings. As an example, right? As an example, first question: I value undergoing potentially painful treatments if they have the potential of prolonging my life, even if they're not my cure, my underlying illness, and may lead to significant discomfort. I agree, disagree, strongly disagree, strongly agree. Next question: I value undergoing potentially painful treatments to try prolonging my life with the goal of participating in a specific occasion, like a family wedding, a bar, or bat mitzvah, birth, even if it will not cure my underlying illness, and may lead to significant discomfort. Like, third question: it is my medical team's responsibility to try to balance pain relief with maintaining my alertness. When it is difficult to maintain both, I prefer to prioritize pain relief or alertness. These are questions the decisions that need to be made, but the problem is it's not always the same. So it's very helpful to have this kind of conversation with the person who may have to represent you legally, and the rabbi who may be advising them, and one's physician, if one's able to have this conversation. And it's an uncomfortable kind of conversation to have. But at the same time, it's really important, because now it informs everybody, because in many circumstances, the person himself is not able to make those decisions. Right? So if the skies are clear, and till the end, and a person is zoche to have a life where they can make the decisions till the end, that's wonderful. And then one can make those decisions. A lot of times, that's not always possible. So one wants to make sure everybody's informed about these things, and a lot of times, people themselves aren't aware of how they'll deal with these situations. This is not legally binding at all. This is not a legal conversation. There's no signatures on this document at all. It is simply a way of conveying what one might think about in these circumstances to those who may have to make the decisions. I had this chus of doing this with somebody on Friday. And this person said to me, I've never had such a more meaningful conversation, because it deals with real issues in life, and it's really important. And so therefore, when somebody is left, and at a certain point in the conversation was, I really don't know what to do. So my response was, well, your sister is going to have to make those decisions for you. So what do you want her to do? What would you want to do in this situation? I don't know. So I said, well, let me paint you a scenario. I'll tell you a suggestion. How do you respond to that suggestion? Having those kind of conversations is important, because now you're going to avoid the situations of guilt, right? The terrible guilt that family might feel in situations where they aren't informed and they don't know the right thing. But now they know, no, this is in that gray area. This is what is important to me. Right, and there's further questions, which are just very helpful. This is not the be all and end all, but there are further questions about social questions. I worry about needing someone to help me on a basic daily activities, like eating and getting dressed and bathing. Agree, disagree, strongly disagree, strongly agree. I worry about becoming lonely or feeling alone. I worry about being an excessive burden on others. These are questions which should be asked. And it's surprising when you ask people about these things. At the end, there's more space for questions like questions about end of life. What are things that worry you about the end of life? What are things which concern you about what you've seen have happened to people you know that really worry you? These are the questions that could happen. So again, I wish it was as simple as just sign the advanced care directive and everything's done. But it's not. Life is complex, and you need to have to discuss these things with the people that matter as well. I'll give you an example. This over here, and I'm not going to show who it is or what it was, but this over here is a healthcare declaration. This was made by an estate planner of somebody's parents in our community. And this person has a template, a legal template, which they applied to this person. And they in the law office had a discussion about end of life. And they say, life-sustaining treatment. I direct that I should be allowed to die with no medication, artificial means, or any extraordinary life-sustaining measure, medical treatment, to be used to prolong my life. If such treatment has been provided, then I direct that such treatment be withdrawn. Measures of artificial life support that I specifically refuse under the circumstances described in the preceding paragraphs include electric or mechanical resuscitation of my heart when it has stopped beating, that's DNR, nutrition and hydration by means of physical or surgical intubation, That's the peg, the artificial nutrition and hydration, and mechanical respiration. The above measures include both existing technology and any methods or techniques that may be hereafter developed and perfected. So the family read this and they said, well, wait a second, does it make sense? Right, so this could be this is in a standard template of estate planning or in the advanced healthcare directive, and it's not appropriate in all circumstances. So in this case, the family was able to catch this and say, wait a second, this doesn't make sense. This is not necessarily in line with halacha, and they were able to change that, but that was because the family took a look at this. It's very important for families to be aware of this and to have a healthcare proxy, because the healthcare proxy allows one to plan for volatile situations where different solutions may be required as well. Sorry, I've been pushing you off a while. Yes.
Is very different than a PAP, than a living will, and they're usually two different documents. A healthcare proctor says, listen to my agent for my medical decisions, but as to nutrition and hydration, and as to DNR, the court or the doctor in the hospital will always say its opinion, and if it's different, if someone, an agent, wants to say something that's against what the doctor and hospital wants, they need clear and convincing evidence, which is in writing, which is why, but we don't, you know, it's hard to navigate the whole, well, you know, if I'm in this situation then, because there could be all kinds of different situations. The problem until about 5 years ago before Obamacare was that they wanted to keep somebody alive and the family didn't want the person to be mutchered. Now with Obamacare, the hospitals are big corporations, the doctors are controlled by the big corporations. They're trying to push palliative care or inactive medicine onto people who may not be ready and whose family may not be ready. I can tell you that about 95% of the time when people want to be put, when the doctors want to put them on palliative care because they think they're going to die within 6 months, they live many years. They live 2 years. And then you have to push back against the doctors and the hospitals by having a living will that says, but I want to stay alive under halachic, under halachic authority. My experience is, though, that there are only maybe two or three rabbis who are really very conversed and sensitive and have the experience to really help families with the situation. I most of the doctors in 35 years don't have that experience. So when putting in a halakha, a rabbi into a healthcare proxy, you have to make sure that they really know what that they've really studied it. And they can also, it also risks the fact that that rabbi will override what the family wants.
Agreed. And I think what you're saying is so important, and sorry, you deal with this all the time. I would say it's so important on all levels to have these conversations ahead of time. And so the worst kind of situation is a rabbi is suddenly called from the ICU bed for the first time, and is on the phone and is asked, can we do X? And they have no patient profile, they have no context, they don't know the patient's wishes, they never had a conversation, and they haven't even spoken to the doctor, right? And now they're trying to figure this out, and the doctor clearly knows, the rabbi doesn't know about this, and the rabbi hasn't spoken to the doctor. That's the worst imaginable situation. Then the rabbi may say something about a specific situation which is not contextualized. The hospital's now left to do this, and it becomes a very difficult situation. Let's go to the opposite end of the spectrum is what I was just talking about, is bring in a rabbi who has experience, who has dealt with these types of situations, sit them down with those who are planning the end of life, whether it be a lawyer, whether it be the doctor, whether it be the healthcare proxy, the family. Let's all talk about these things while we can. Right? Let's have the conversation. What do you want this not to look like? What do you want this to look like? What are the parameters that we can touch? What are the parameters we cannot touch? Then, if Mr. Shem, in many years' time, when this becomes an issue, now we have what to talk about. That is the opposite end of the spectrum.
Now they're in the hospitals, they have hospitalists. They don't know the patient. You can't bring your own doctor in. You can't pre-plan it because of whoever the hospital is.
It becomes more complicated.
As you walk in,
but they are bound legally by healthcare proxies. So that's the only thing which can hold things in place. The healthcare proxy needs to be strong enough, educated enough, and have enough context for the patient wants, because they cannot violate that patient autonomy. So that's what this is providing, essentially, legally. I just add to your point as well. I mean, just in the last year, I went to visit somebody in the hospital. It was an ICU at St. Francis, and the doctor on the way out said, oh, you're a rabbi. You're the rabbi. So let me just call you aside. I want to just tell you, you know, I was studying the Talmud, and there was a story about Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, and they started praying that he should die, you know, because it was just too much, right? This is like a conservative Jewish doctor. And what they were essentially saying is like, it's time to tell the family to basically just, you know, this person's not going anywhere there, and right, so it's just, you know, do a palliative care, and that's a goodbye, and we need an extra bed in the ICU. So I called up the family. And I said, you know, this is what this doctor said, and he didn't feel that there's much hope. And the family said, you know, it's so funny, because just this morning we spoke to Dr. Meir Abitan, who works in St. Francis, and he said, maybe you should have a conversation with him. I called up Dr. Abitan, and he's like, what are you talking about? They have no way of knowing this person's brain activity. This person, they're telling you to put him in palliative care. You have no idea. I've seen this person. I saw that he reacted when somebody walked into the room. Like, why? I know this doctor. This doctor always tries to get people onto palliative care. He says, it's not my ward, but I want to tell you that. And to his credit, the family did not listen to that to put him in palliative care. And although it was difficult, this person did remain alive, and he lived to see the birth of his first great-grandchild. And although he couldn't speak, it was very evident that he knew that he had a great-grandchild when she was brought into the room. It was very evident. And so, like, you're like, it's very hard. There's a lot of different, and sometimes it's very easy to be swayed by a particular voice. One has to have a holistic picture, which involves one's healthcare, one involves a halacha, which involves one's wishes, right? And because if a person can't speak, how do you communicate that if we haven't had these kind of conversations? So the general rule is a little bit of planning, a little bit of conversations are so important, because, and putting somebody there who can make those decisions on one behalf if one cannot communicate those as well. Yeah. Exactly.
What happened with us?
Yep,
I've been in Denver, and then he had said DNR.
Right. So that's what I'm saying, is that there's a lot of things where one cannot plan. One tries, and one does the shtadlus, but it's not always going to be the way one tries or one's best as well. I think it's just important, and about all these things is earlier discussions. It should be, as of course, no one likes to have these kinds of discussions, but it can be incredibly meaningful for family as well. I discussed the discussion with the person, and one of the questions was a social question, is I'm scared of feeling lonely. And the person said, strongly agree. I would never have guessed, because the person is a very strong person, they're a loner, and they're so on. And then that's going to inform how we try to help them find their way out of the nursing home, where they're going to be, because they do feel lonely. But like, you would never have known that without having that discussion, because that's not what they give off, as an example. Got one of the complicated questions. We're not under so much time right now, but organ donation. So organ donation is a really important thing. It saves lives, and the Torah believes, the Torah teaches us that it is of paramount importance to save lives. This is the greatest thing. Jews. This is an incredibly high value. The problem is that organ donation itself is a complicated topic, because a organ needs to be harvested while still getting a blood supply. And so most organs today are harvested at a time where there still is a blood supply, which is at a state what's called brain death, or brain stem death. And that's when a person, essentially, their brain has died, the stem of the brain has died, but they're on a machine, and the machine is still allowing the heart to pump, and the heart is its internal, has its own mechanism which allows it to continue to sustain blood. The blood is providing oxygen to the limbs of the body, to the organs. So in such a state where a person is declared legally dead, because there is no reaction, the person will never recover. There's nothing left of them. It's just a body which is pumping blood. In that case, in such a circumstance, in different states it's slightly different, but it's constant. There's different ways to test this. There's absolutely no reaction. eyes down the throat, gagging, the machine's taken off, the heart does not take, it does not carry on, various tests. In such a situation, a person is declared legally dead, but there's a discussion in halacha as to whether death is defined by a person's breathing or a person's heart beating. If it's breathing, this person's not breathing, right? So if you take off the machine, they won't breathe. But if it's about their heart beating, their heart is beating because there is a natural pacemaker in the heart. Hashem made it this amazing thing. The heart itself has its own pacemaker independent of the brain. And it will carry on beating if oxygen is being pumped into it, and that's what's happening, right? So that being the case, it becomes a very complicated debate because therefore, according to that opinion, that it's based on the heart beating, then by harvesting those organs at that point in time, you're killing the patient. You're not allowed to save somebody else by killing another person. That's what's one of the Gimel Chamuras, right? You're not allowed to murder to save another person's life. That's one of the precise, and that would be the situation according to that opinion. So that's why it becomes a complicated situation in halacha, in Judaism, and so just to be aware of it in Israel, based on the psak of Rav Avadia Yosef, based on the psak of Rav Moshe Feinstein. In the Israeli legal system, which was passed in Knesset, brain death is considered with a sufficient testing, which is much better there than here, because of the considerations in halacha, then it would be considered death and a person would be able to harvest the organs. Here in America, and even in Israel, Rav Yashiv is against this, based on opinions that were discussed. It's a much, much more complicated topic of hours worth of decisions. The RCA, following Rav Schechter's pshat, holds that brain death is not considered death. This is a major, major debate as well, which is to be had, which is why you'll see there is something called HODS, Halachic Organ Donation Society, and they work within the opinions that it's all right. I mean, Israel, it's a lot easier, but it's a lot more accepted, first of all, for a number of reasons. Is that, first of all, is the testing is much, one of the, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was prepared to accept that brain death is death. He was concerned about the physician testing the person. Are they doing the sufficient enough test to know that the brainstem is truly dead or not? Right, and the person might be in a state of a goisase where a person can't be moved, but how can you perform the testing necessary to be able to do that? That was a little bit of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's concern. And Dr. Steinberg, who was a Talmud of his, worked with him. Now it is possible to see if there's brainstem death without moving the patient, and believes that Rav Shlomo Zalman would, in this situation, agree that a person is considered halachically dead as well. But it also relates to the fact that society needs it. Meaning to say, is that one of the big questions that's on an Orthodox jury is you're taking organs, but you're not giving organs, right? That's one of the biggest situations that arises today, and certainly in the American milieu. In Israel, that we don't have that flexibility, right? If there's no organs being donated, it's just nobody's going to be saved, right? In that society, you need this. You need this opinion, and you need this to be legalized in Israel for that to work. And by the way, do Orthodox Jews care about donating organs to save people's lives? The answer is absolutely yes. And how do you know? Because of kidney transplants or kidney donations, meaning the highest amount. I mean, look at the numbers of kidney donations in America. Orthodox Jewry is so exponentially beyond its proportion in society about kidney donations, because you can do that while you're alive without anybody being in a state of brain death, right? Because there's two kidneys. And that's clearly, right, people are doing this left, right, and center. Every other week, there's another Orthodox Jew donating a kidney. The problem becomes the end of life. When it enters a situation, it requires speaking to a rav that one's comfortable with and going through this. It is a complex situation, so and it's obviously very sensitive, because on the one hand, some people view this as murder. On the other hand, people see this as life saving. That's a very, very big spectrum to deal with, which is part of this as well. This is something which is necessary to talk about, and it's important to discuss, because today on your New York driver's license, your preference about organ donation is going to be there. And the reason is because if a person, God forbid, is involved in a traffic accident and a person is taken to the hospital, that person could save multiple other people if they do have their organ donor. The organ donor list in this country, the lists are extensive. To get an organ when you need one is a very, very long wait. And so literally saving lives, but with this complexity. Now, another aspect of which also in end of life planning is halachic will. So the halachic will relates to the complexity that if you learn Parashas Pinchas, and as is clear in halacha, is that the way that that division of a state works in the natural Jewish way, without any interventions, if a person does not give any gifts, a person passes away, it goes first to son, then to daughter, right, and then also descendants, and which creates problems and complications in our society today when we have, let's say, a person has a son and a daughter, and the person wants to divide the assets between the son and the daughter, as an example, right? These are complicated situations. The Gemara talks about the problems of being ma'avir nachla, of taking away a nachla, which the Torah naturally prescribes in this way. I would highly recommend Dayan Grunfeld has a book on this. He wrote an entire book on this particular topic, so it's not a small topic. The reasons, the ideas, the legacy behind it's such a fascinating book on Jewish inheritance. I actually have it in my office. We have it in our library upstairs in the shul, and there are various solutions as to how to do this. There is what's called a halachic will. The halachic will essentially, and one can, it's very easy. I actually print out Rav Willig's one, which is to be found here, if anybody needs it over here. It's essentially a document which is a gift before death, which would match the legal will as well, or with the acceptance of the natural heir, to willingness to accept this, or a gift will be given to remove the assets that they would have received otherwise. So in order to effectuate the same outcome. Diane Grunfeld, at the back of his Sefer, has a much longer and extensive halachic will written in Hebrew and in English, and it's really worthwhile looking at this, speaking to one's lawyer, and making sure that something is signed, because the last thing what we want, because it would be the situation where one party is going to be suing another party in one's family in court afterwards based on the halachic grounds and the legal, there being a disparity between one's legal will and the halachic process of nachlas. Easy, it's better to align those ahead of time to avoid any machlokas. Unfortunately, all you need is a little bit of money to create a lot of machlokas. So it's really worthwhile to discuss these things as well. We'll do one last thing today, and then we'll leave the rest for next time. But one is vidui as well. So vidui is a very important thing, which is why we do it every day, right? Slach lano vinu ki chatano, mechalano malkenu ki foshano, right? We do that every day. But there's a special vidui said at the end of life as well. What is that? So this is discussed in the Mishnah. It's discussed many, many places where one phrases it in the following. The most basic form of vidui at the end of life is Misasi tehei kapara al kol ahavonos. Is that let the process of passing be a kapara as well. Where the way the Rambam phrases this is that the Rambam points out that there are certain levels of averos that a person can commit that require tshuva, and tshuva can fix them. But there's certain ones which are more egregious, that it's not just tshuva, but tshuva and Yom Kippur would need to fix them. But there's some things which are more egregious that tshuva and Yom Kippur don't fix. Tshuva, Yom Kippur, and death fix. And then there's ones which even death doesn't fix as well. What's in that category, by the way? The Rambam says in Chilul Hashem. This is all in the beginning of Hilchos Tshuva. This is all halacha. So if that's the case, let's go to the category three there for a second, where a person does aver, which is so significant that they need to do tshuva, real tshuva, not just, I'm sorry, real tshuva, the pain of tshuva, and the a Yom Kippur and death. But then you need to actually mindfully associate the death with that process, and that's what this video is. The meaning the person is saying is that anything I have to go through, the pain, the trauma, the fear that goes through this, let all of that be part of the kapara that is that death should be warranting. It's all it's doing is aligning that experience with the process, the spiritual process which is going on. And it's important to be able to do that if one is able to do this as well. So now you say to yourself, wait a second, isn't this just gonna scare somebody? Right, I mean to say it's going to, by saying, let's do vidui, you're essentially saying, okay, time to throw the towel in, isn't it? Right, so the truth is that the way the Shulchan Aruch describes this, and the Shulchan Aruch says that the way it's important to be said is one should say to a person, many have said vidui and recovered. Many have not said vidui and did not recover, which means to say, the two are not associated with each other. Death and vidui are not associated, but it's important to have this in place. And so therefore, it is better to do. Now, a lot of times, there's a mistake which is made. It's that people will often ask about vidui when the patient is no longer able to be conscious or say anything. it's really important that a person be able to say viruk. It's not always possible because a person may have an episode of, God forbid, a stroke, and they're not in a situation where they can speak, right? That's not always the case, and one can do it on their behalf. But ideally, it should be the person themselves being able to say the viruk, because it's tei misasi kaporo al kol avonasai. And therefore, if that's the case, one should really try, if one has a doubt whether one's person will be able to communicate in the future, say, now's a good time, let's do this. Now, at the same time, it's important to know, but I know people who, Jonathan did with many, many people who lived for many, many years. We just discussed that just recently. It's an amazing thing. It's a very powerful thing. It's a very, very moving thing if done correctly and emotionally sensitively enough. But having said that, at the same time, it's important, the Shulchan Aruch does say, is remove from the room people who don't understand this, meaning to say, there's going to be a child, there's going to be a sibling who's going to burst out crying, right? That's going to now deteriorate the person's situation because they're going to be now moved by that. So if there's somebody who cannot control their emotions, they should be removed from the room, right? But for the person themselves, a lot of situations is the person themselves is much more aware of what's going on than the family, right? A lot of times, if they're lucid, they know what's happening and it's everybody else who's struggling. So have that conversation in that situation as well. Are there other things to be said? And the answer is absolutely. There are other things which can and should be said as well. So for instance, there is a specific Tehillim to be said towards the end of life passage. Tehillim Kuf Chaf Aleph, Kuf Lamed, Litzadi Aleph, Yigdal Adon Olam, Ana Bekoyach, Alkei Nekaveh. These are prayers. And in fact, you can get hold of these. So if you Google this, you can look at the ultimate passage on Chabad's website. They have these. It's all there. I'm happy to provide. The RCA has a section on end of life. The new RCA Madrich has it as well. These are beautiful things, and these can be said multiple times. And I'll add one thing here: not just said, sung. Don't underappreciate the value of song, because when a person's in a situation where they're in a space where they're just struggling with the energy to retain consciousness, to fight off the pain, song penetrates much more than words as well. And it's important to be able to sing these as well. It's very, very moving. It's very, very meaningful and can be extremely comforting. And these can be done multiple times. Yes.
The nurse told me that hearing is the last sense a person has. They could be completely sedated, out, no reaction, but the hearing is going on. So singing is very, very important.
It is incredibly important to this as well. And you see it. Yes, yes.
Is the mitzvah of inheritance mandatory, or is it mandatory like every day if I don't go to Bikur Cholim to Mevakeh Cholim, it's not like I'm sinning. If a person wants to do the mitzvah of inheritance according to the Torah, is it okay, it's nice that you want to do it, or is it a sin if he doesn't do it?
That's a really good question. I would advise reading the book. It's really not long. I'm happy to give it to you, Suri, because you deal with this all the time. And it would be really, really worthwhile to read through it. It's not long. But
also covers it.
Oh, fantastic. Right. Feldman just covers it.
This exact discussion. Right. Because there was one to some, there was a, maybe you should do part of it within Torah and part of it the other way.
So it does seem that there is an obligation to avoid what's called ma'avarta nachla, which is completely avoiding a Torah situation. As to why that is, Rav Grunfeld actually comes down. Diane Grunfeld comes out to the point that it is a chok. We don't know why particularly it goes this way, but this is something we do need to uphold to a certain degree. But at the same time, to also provide to make sure that the everybody's taken care of. So it can and should be done. But I just think that most people are not well versed enough in this, and it's very simple to set up. So I'm happy to show you both documents that can be done. Very, very easy to set this up so that one's will has been set up and one's halachic will is set up so that everything is moving in tandem, that one's planned sufficiently as well. I'm going to stop over here because we really are at time, and I don't want to get to the next step, which unfortunately is the end of the end as well. But Be'ezrat Hashem will continue. And the takeaway from today is a really, really important idea. And that is, have conversations. Discuss these things. If there are nagging doubts, have conversations. Now, we should all have these conversations, and we should all be zochim to many good, strong, and wonderful, healthy years.